This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
It was 6 years ago, in 2014, when an Indigenous Australian man named George Nelson completed a book which documented his family's ancestry. He was 80 years of age, and the book had been the culmination of his life's quest to trace his roots. Growing up, he heard many stories about his family members, and he felt an intense desire to find out all he could. But there was one person in particular who sparked his interest, a man who was often spoken about so lovingly. That man was his great-grandfather. This is Apple for the Teacher, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Anna Thomas. Today's episode is called To Sir with Love. George spent his life tracing the story of his great-grandfather. What did he find out? George was born in 1933, and although now in his 80s, George remembered his great-grandfather, Thomas Shadrach James, or as he was affectionately known, just simply Grandpa James. George remembers visiting Grandpa James and his Grandma Ada. George knew he had been a teacher, but had since retired. Here, George describes what he remembered about Grandpa James. I had spent some of my early years growing up around Grandpa and saw how loved and respected he was and how highly everyone spoke of him. I heard many stories from the elders around me about the wonderful man that he was, teaching Aboriginal children at the Mullaga and Coomera missions. They also talked about how loving, gentle, and selfless he was. As I got older, I even heard Dad, his brothers and sisters, and other family members speaking of how Grandpa's teaching had led to the creation of wonderful leaders in our community. He said, "Now, for me as a little boy and then a young man, these stories about Grandpa were all very mysterious, fascinating, intriguing, and yet seemed surreal to me. As a 5 to 7 year old, in the years after Grandpa retired from teaching, I would be in and out of his home, watching him sitting quietly reading his Bible day after day, or see the many people, both black and white, coming to his door, seeking his counsel or renowned herbal treatments. He had a real presence about him, and I could see why so many people were drawn to him. As a child, you don't see the difference between people of different colours, but as I started to take more notice of Grandpa, I started to see that although he was black, he was a different kind of black to us Aboriginal people. Regardless of that difference, he was completely one of us, through and through, but it added to the mystery that was Grandpa and raised many more questions in my mind. So, as I got older, I started to wonder, how could this quiet, distinguished, elderly man have had such an impact, as the stories say? And I was determined to find out. I thought I would stop playing outside for a few minutes, go and ask the adults a few questions, and return to playing with all the answers in hand. Little did I know it would take me 73 years to find the answers to my questions. So, George then set off on a lifelong journey to find out everything he could about his family. The decades of searching resulted in a book that was published 6 years ago. The name of the book is Dharmalan Dana. Dharmalan Dana translates to Grandfather's Pathway. George's family were from the Yorta Yorta Nation, and Dharmalan Dana is from their ancestral language. This story will now go on to describe what George uncovered. From this point in the story, we will refer to Grandpa James by his first name, Thomas. As already mentioned, as a child, George had noticed that his Grandpa Thomas was a different kind of black, and he would go on to find out something about him which demonstrated just how astute George had been. Thomas's own father was of Indian descent and had moved from India to the island of Mauritius in 1854. Mauritius is an island in the Indian Ocean east of southern Africa and south of Madagascar. Mauritius had been under French control until the British took control in 1810 during the Napoleonic War. Thomas's father had married in India and had several children, and then it was after they moved to Mauritius that Thomas was born in 1859. Back in India, Thomas's father had been a teaching assistant and even went on to establish an Indian Christian school in Mauritius. Thomas went on to help his father at the school, and as we will see, Thomas's life in Australia would mirror that of his father. After setting up their new life in Mauritius, tragedy then struck when Thomas's mother died. Thomas was heartbroken, but he became more brokenhearted when his father married another lady within a short space of time. It appears that Thomas could not face the thought of having a stepmother. So, in his late teens, he decided to leave Mauritius. He went down to the ship docks and inquired with the ship captains about coming aboard as a seaman. One of the captains agreed, and Thomas then embarked on a journey to Australia. It's not clear from George's research whether Thomas knew he was heading to Australia, but it seems he wanted to be anywhere but Mauritius. Thomas's destination turned out to be the island of Tasmania in the southernmost part of Australia. The year was 1875. He started applying for teaching jobs, although he wasn't actually a qualified teacher. There was no evidence found that he actually taught in Tasmania, but it seems that he hadn't stayed there for long and eventually made his way to the city of Melbourne, which was the closest city on mainland Australia to Tasmania. Over the years, George had heard many stories that Thomas had studied medicine in Melbourne, but this couldn't be confirmed as the university records had been lost in a fire. But from what family members had said over the years, it seemed that he did start studying medicine, but then had to withdraw after coming down with typhoid. It was then that a chance meeting would change the course of Thomas's life. He met a man named Daniel Matthews, who was a Christian missionary and schoolteacher. He had established an Aboriginal mission in 1874 called the Malaga Mission. He wanted to do something to improve the lives of Aboriginal people. So, Matthews went on to establish the mission on the banks of the Murray River in the state of New South Wales. The Indigenous people of the area were from the Yorta Yorta Nation. The mission also started a school with his wife Janet teaching at the school. Matthews would travel and visit various Aboriginal groups in the area and encourage them to come and live on the mission, promising them a better life. It was during one of these visits that Thomas first came to meet Matthews, who inspired him to go to Malaga and offer his assistance. The mission school received official recognition as a state school 7 years after it was opened. However, when Thomas came to teach at the school as an assistant to Matthews, that was when things began to change for the better. He soon became a much loved teacher and mentor, and he was able to encourage more and more children to attend the school. Then it became necessary for the mission to move to another location at a place called Kumarugunga, or just Kumara for short. Matthews then stood down from teaching, and Thomas took over as the head teacher. He wasn't actually a qualified teacher, but he was able to take studies and eventually did become fully qualified. As well as teaching children, he set up what was called the Scholars' Hut for adult men and women. They learned literacy and numeracy skills, but also leadership skills and politics. Over the many years that Thomas worked at the mission, he wore a number of hats, including school teacher, church minister, herbalist, doctor, dentist, truancy officer, electoral officer, social worker, surgeon, and became a much trusted friend and confidant to everyone. He also established and ran the dispensary there. Then he added further roles as a husband and father. He met and married a local Aboriginal woman from the Yorta Yorta Nation named Ada, and they went on to have 8 children, many of whom went on to have their own roles at the mission. Although Thomas achieved much at the school, it wasn't without its challenges. He often wrote letters to the education authorities voicing his concerns: the lack of school equipment, books, writing materials, furniture, sickness, small classrooms. But much fell on deaf ears, and he often used his own personal funds to provide the children with the basics. He called the education program that he provided Leading and Writing. I just love this. So instead of reading and writing, he called it Leading and Writing. And the success in his approach can be seen in the many students who went on to do great things in the Australian political scene at the time. In the early years of the British colony in Australia, there were challenges with getting Aboriginal children to attend school consistently, and Thomas's school was no different. However, he achieved more success than most. He would visit the children's parents, and the rapport that he built worked wonders. Here is what he said: "Certain results, such as good attendance and punctuality, are attainable, and these I have maintained for many years as a result of constantly visiting and reasoning with parents, speaking to the scholars themselves, and seeking at all times to make their work in school a pleasure rather than a task." As already seen, the conditions at the school were inadequate for Thomas to provide a solid education for his pupils. Although he did much with the little that he had, but he also had to contend with many outbreaks of sickness amongst the children, such as scarlet fever, influenza, whooping cough, which would see a larger number of children being away from school for weeks and months on end. These contagious diseases would pass from one student to another very quickly, and Thomas himself became ill a number of times, then having to take significant time away from school to recover, which resulted in the school being temporarily closed. As well as fevers and influenza, he also had lung and kidney issues, and it appears the stressful conditions at the school also contributed to these issues. He was constantly fighting with the authorities to have the school conditions improved. He also experienced racism against himself, but also the Aboriginal community. He often felt powerless, and so all this placed enormous strain and stress upon his health and well-being, as he literally worried himself sick. He often agonized about why the authorities weren't taking his concerns about the school seriously. Did they think he was just exaggerating? Then at one point, the school had a visit from clergymen who confirmed what Thomas had been saying. They found the school to be highly unsanitary, and the airflow in the school building was insufficient. So it was no wonder that sickness spread so quickly. Here is what they reported: "The school building is altogether inadequate for the health requirements of so many children, and in a warm climate such as this, must be deleterious to the health of the children and the teacher. The teacher's residence, I venture to say, is the worst provided for any teacher in the colony. One's head almost touches the tin roof. And although unsuitable in the colder portions of the year, in the summer months, it's a marvel to me that the teacher and his family have not been stricken down by a serious illness." During his time at the school, Thomas took leave on a number of occasions to return to Mauritius and visit his family. On one particular occasion, a replacement teacher was appointed during his absence. The new teacher wasn't aware that the appointment was at an Aboriginal mission, and subsequently wrote to the Chief Inspector of Schools saying, "I protest against my placement at this school, as I was not aware when I received the appointment that the place was an Aboriginal mission station, and the children attending the school are blacks. Had I known, I would have declined to accept the appointment, and considering the way a single teacher has to live here, it would require a man with a very much stronger constitution than I possess to endure it." Oh my goodness, are you kidding? Who is this man? How can he call himself a teacher? And as we have seen, he was correct that Thomas did endure such hard conditions, which says a lot about his character. Despite his complaints, they were not able to find a replacement quickly, and the man was told that he would have to remain until Thomas returned. The man subsequently found this unsatisfactory and took extended sick leave. But this wasn't entirely surprising, as racism was par for the course in Australia at that time. As seen, Thomas faced many challenges at the school, and another one soon presented itself when a new manager was appointed to the mission, George Harris. He pushed for white children to be provided with their own separate school. The education department investigated the option and in a report stated the following: "I am informed by responsible people in the locality that Mr. Harris has concerns of the influence exercised by Mr. James over the Aboriginals. I am of the opinion that white and dark children should not be taught in the same school when the dark children predominate, and am in sympathy with the petitioners for the need for a separate school. I propose to look carefully into the matter when making the annual inspection." This is a very interesting insight into the times, not just for the racism and desire for segregation, but it also showed that they were getting weary that Thomas was teaching the Aboriginals how to stand up for themselves and to demand better treatment. The Aboriginal Protection Board at the time began feeling that the Aboriginal people were getting too confident about standing up for their rights and believed the solution was to break up Aboriginal communities and send them out into the broader community. They also started planning to take Aboriginal children away from their families and train them as domestic servants. The taking of Aboriginal children from their families went on to become official government policy. The children who were removed went on to be referred to as the Stolen Generations, and the policy of forcible removal continued until the 1970s. I covered two episodes about the so-called Stolen Generations in episodes 68 and 69. So, we saw that a new manager arrived at the mission, George Harris, and he soon set about undermining Thomas and went on to submit letters of complaint against him. Here is how Thomas responded: "Mr. Harris has been unjustifiably harassing me and therefore hampering me in my work. In submitting my grievance, I beg to assure you, sir, that I entertain no feeling of ill will to Mr. Harris, but am actuated by a sense of duty which I owe to my department, to the Aboriginal Protection Board, to myself and my family, and to the community in which I have been labouring for the last 29 years with a fair measure of success. Mr. Harris has repeatedly put obstacles in my way in relation to the school. 3 years ago, noticing his coolness towards me, I approached him with the best intention of seeking a quiet conference with him to clear away the misunderstanding that had crept between us, but I was met with a sharp rebuff. Mr. Harris's magisterial manner toward me, his reckless utterances, his unjustifiable insinuations are hateful, intolerable, and harmful, and certainly unbecoming of an officer responsible for the social and moral elevation of this community. He charged me with treacherously influencing the Aborigines here to petition the board for his removal and my appointment as manager. I deny the charge and quietly repudiated the stigma he had so unjustly hurled upon my character. Again and again, he has spoken disparagingly of me to the people in the store and dispensary." There was also a witness that was able to confirm that Harris had said the following: "I will shift Mr. James before long. A coloured man is no good here. We shall have a white man here." Thomas was also forced to write a letter of complaint about the station's overseer, who had been overheard saying, "Mr. James is no good here. He doesn't know his own mind. He knows nothing about teaching children. Mr. James is only preaching to gain sympathy." Thomas again wrote letters of complaint against the overseer, saying, "Mr. Wilkinson is acting in such a way that will jeopardize my influence as a teacher here. I felt compelled to bring these unpleasant matters before you, and it's with no desire to inflict a wrong upon Mr. Wilkinson. All I wish is that he shall be given to know that it is his duty to help and not to hinder." The chief inspector investigated Thomas's complaints and made the following statement. An exhaustive inquiry was held into the charges referred by the teacher, Mr. James, against the manager, Mr. Harris, and overseer, Mr. Wilkinson. While we are of the opinion that the charges are of a petty character and hardly worthy of notice, the inquiry disclosed that there is a considerable amount of friction between the manager and the teacher, and that the services of both officers cannot be retained on the station. Whether due to the strained relationship with Mr. James or not, Mr. Harris has lost control over the men on the station, and there is little hope of his ever being able to regain such control. We are therefore of the opinion that a change is necessary in the management and recommend that Mr. Harris be replaced by a suitable man. So, a victory for Thomas and the community at large. Here is how George responded to his grandfather's victory. These letters of complaint by Grandpa not only tell us about Grandpa's day-to-day fight for our rights and those of his family and the community, but they also give us great insights into the type of man that he was. As we read his letters, we can just see the anguish in his words, the despair and frustration every time he had to write back to those who denied his requests or failed to see the enormity of the situation he was describing. But still, he would at all times be courteous, professional, always knowing his place and never pushing the argument too far. The way that Thomas fought for the rights of the Indigenous people came from his own Indian heritage. He would often talk about how the Indians stood up against the British occupation. George described Thomas's actions as being like the great Gandhi. Quote, "I believe that Grandpa provided a glimmer of hope for our people who were deeply oppressed by British settlers, just as Gandhi did for his Indian people who were equally as oppressed by the British. Grandpa's passive resistance tactics, along with his religious faith, his ability to quietly protest against injustices, and his ongoing commitment to bettering the lives of Aboriginal people by educating our people to be leaders and writers, was also, in my personal view, a beacon of hope for the oppressed and marginalised here at Malaga and at Kamara, if not further afield. It was the beginning of our people to be able to forge ahead and take a strong stand against the oppression that we had suffered since colonization, just as the people of India had done so many years before." Thomas went on to serve the community for 40 years, and during that time, he pushed for various reforms, which sadly, towards the end of his career, was not seen favorably by the Education Department or the Aboriginal Protection Board. He was increasingly viewed as a troublemaker who incited students to agitate for reform. The board thus moved to end his employment, saying it was not in the best interests of the Aborigines for him to stay. But Thomas wouldn't go so easily and stayed on for another 2 years until he was forced into retirement in 1922. So the former manager, George Harris, finally got what he wanted after 10 years of trying. So what was his crime? Simply put, over-educating Aboriginals. But although he was forced into retirement, Thomas's influence continued as many of his own children worked as teaching assistants on the mission, including one of his sons. He continued his father's work to fight for the rights of the Aboriginal people, but eventually the board issued an expulsion order against him. He refused to leave and was then threatened with prosecution for trespass. He ultimately left, deciding to study law in Melbourne. Then we fast forward almost 40 years after Thomas retired, which was almost as long as his teaching career. It was at this time when a very significant event happened on the mission. Almost 200 Aboriginal people walked off the mission in protest over a number of the poor conditions. A newly appointed manager had humiliated and oppressed the people, and they finally had enough. They voiced their contempt for the protection board, and the manager was eventually transferred. The walk-off was able to gain good press coverage, which succeeded in embarrassing the board. Their stand had a major effect on bringing about changes to the Aborigines Act. So once again, this demonstrated the legacy that Thomas had left behind. Many of those leading the civil rights movement had been his own students. And although he was in official retirement, he continued to work behind the scenes, advising and mentoring the next generation of political activists. So what did Thomas get up to after retiring? He and his wife Ada settled down to a quieter life. Not that Thomas ever really slowed down. As we've seen, he continued to agitate behind the scenes. It was Ada, his wife, who passed away first in 1942 at the age of 74. But everyone also noticed that Thomas's health was declining, and many visitors came to see him in those last days. Here is George's recollection. The adults in the house were all talking intensively every moment of every day about Grandpa's health, saying that he didn't have long. This all seemed so surreal to me because Grandpa was always such a huge figure in our lives. He was always such a central figure in our family and community that news of his impending death just didn't make sense at all. I guess now for me, as a 12-year-old kid, there hadn't been much loss in my short life. I probably hadn't really tackled the whole concept of death and dying. So it came as a real shock to me the day that Grandpa passed away. He was such an incredible presence in my life, and the thought of never seeing him again was unfathomable. It just wasn't possible. Thomas died in 1946 at the age of 87, 4 years after his wife, Ada. George went on to say, the family kept him in the house for a day for visitors to come and say their goodbyes before he was taken away, and they still kept coming from far and wide. There was a lot of crying, sobbing, and heartbreak. I heard Nanny and her sisters wailing in despair and crying out for their Dada, the name she and her siblings affectionately called their father. It was clear, even to us as little kids, that Grandpa was very much loved and would be so deeply missed. Because Grandpa has always been described as a self-effacing man, modest, kind, and gentle, it would not be in his nature to take credit for or to be a visible part of an issue that was quintessentially Aboriginal. However, the evidence speaks for itself. It had been shown time and time again that Grandpa's influence on the community was profound in so many ways. Grandpa was a peaceful man, and so were our people. There was no evidence or aggression in his activism. The protests of the 1930s were peaceful but forceful. Grandpa stoked the fire of rebellion behind the scenes, but was never seen brandishing a torch. This was why Grandpa was considered such a danger. It was known that he was influencing the agitation of the day, and this is what led to the Aboriginal Protection Board to instigate his removal in 1922. The fact that Grandpa was originally from Mauritius matters little. He became part of our Aboriginal community of Malaga and Coomera on the Murray River through marriage and by his unceasing determination to better the lives of our people, who were his people too. The legacy of his work continues to be apparent today in the descendants of the many students that he taught long ago. He really was a remarkable man who taught and inspired a generation of Aboriginal leaders, and we still talk about him today, with our community members still referring to him as Grandpa James. His memory still shines strongly for our Yorta Yorta people, his descendants, and even further afield. Grandpa knew very well that the power of the pen was mightier than the sword, and he encouraged his students and the community to fight for their rights through leading and writing, and instilling in them the confidence to do so. And now, George talks here about his own life's journey to document his family history. This past 73 years of research, including the 6 years of international research and the last 3 years of writing this story, has been an almighty challenge. Now, writing the ending to this story and seeing the final result, it has all been worth it. It's enriching to be able to pass on the stories to the next generations, as I have learnt, lived, and been told them. It's important that we all take time to tell the stories to our younger ones, because that is how our old people live on through the generations. That's what keeps our culture alive in our hearts, minds, and memories. We are all capable of great things if we have a dream, a belief in self, a sense of adventure, and at the end of the day, live our truth. We can inspire the next generations just as the last ones inspired us. And we can leave our footprints deeply embedded in the sand, just as Grandpa and our ancestors have done. George's book came out about 6 years ago, and if he still is alive, he would be 87. The book is really long. It's almost 400 pages, and I was amazed how comprehensive it was and how he managed to find so much information about the family from the 1800s. He went to Mauritius a number of times and was able to find and visit many of his relatives. Isn't that just amazing? And I also found this story interesting on another level, in that I wondered why I had never heard about this brilliant man. Our Australian history books seem to document much about the British explorers who discovered Australia, the British convicts, the Australian outlaws, such as the bushranger Ned Kelly, and we also know much about our sporting heroes, but this man was just as much a person of note. Yet it seems that his life isn't interesting and sensational enough as the convicts and the bushrangers. Just like in true crime, the perpetrators get so much of the attention. The good apples just don't seem to rate that highly, which is a real shame. But I'm so glad that I was able to bring this Good Apple story to you, which is the very first episode, which was totally a Good Apple story. But I can't take the credit, as it was actually given to me by one of our Facebook group members, Kate Annells. So thank you so much, Kate. So many of you have given me wonderful stories, and it shows that you really understand the type of stories that I like to present. I didn't want this podcast just to be about gruesome murders, although there have been many of these. But as you know, I rather look for the human angles, people whose lives that we can learn something from, and people whose lives shouldn't be forgotten. So thank you to Kate and to everyone else. And now, here is a preview of the next episode. It's called Harem. Soraya was a schoolgirl living in the African country of Libya. What happened to her? And to end this episode, I will leave you with this quote. It's the teacher that makes the difference, not the classroom. Bye for now, and remember to be a good apple.